Nothing worthwhile. Mediocre podcasting. Today, tomorrow, forever.
Hello?
Hello. I need you to come up to the show. I need you to do something for me.
What?
I need you to do something for me. It's one of Audie's favorites.
Who are you?
Scott the Engineer.
Who do you think you're talking to?
I need you to come up here and ride the Sibian.
No, I'm not going nowhere.
How about coming up here and getting topless? Any problem with that?
I'm not going anyplace. Nowhere. And if you call me again, you're in big trouble.
Topless.
Topless?
T-O-P-L-E-S-S?
I know what you're saying.
Yeah, okay. Now, you do it when you get here, you'll do it.
I'm 82 years old, and I'm not going no place.
I need you to come up here and ride the Sibian.
Would you go straight to hell and quit calling me?
Okay, fine.
Hello?
Topless. No problem with that?
Yes, there's a problem with that. I'm not doing it.
No, you do it when you get here, you'll do it.
I am not going nowhere.
How about coming up here and getting topless?
No.
Either you're going to bang her, Audie, or she sends us about 15, you're not
going
to get shit from her. Are you
going
to come up? We want you to come up.
I'm not going no place.
Yeah, okay. You'll do it. You'll do it.
No.
No, you do it when you get here, you'll do it.
No.
Topless.
No.
No problem with that?
I'm not doing it, you son of a bitch.
T-O-P-L-E-S-S. Topless.
I don't get topless.
No, are you going to come up to the show?
No.
No problem with that? I need you to come up here and ride your Sibian. Yeah, she sounds like she's immature, though.
They think they can get away with murder.
This is gasoline.
But they didn't count on one thing.
Does he have any other relatives? Anyone else that could possibly help?
You gave up your family when you joined the Legion.
I never give up my family.
He's trained to fight for his life. Now, he's fighting for revenge.
Just tell him Joshua's here with somebody I think she'd like to meet.
Sure you want to mess up that face, handsome?
It's a game.
Hey, I got 3-1 against Lionheart.
He's playing for keeps. But now, he's facing the ultimate challenge.
That's him. A born killer. Not some bum we picked off the street.
Well, this dude's already bagged 8 bodies.
I'll beat the guy I have to.
The rules are simple.
There's no rules.
The stakes are high.
What I did tonight, I did for my family.
You win. You live.
Now what's it gonna be?
You lose. You die.
It's going to be simple.
Bandana is...
Live from the Last of the Action Heroes Podcast Network Studios, It's Nothing Worthwhile presents Van Damme It, a podcast about Jean-Claude Van Damme. Here's Evan Moody and Andrew Gruthius.
Everybody was kung fu.
Knock Su Cow, everybody. Knock Su Cow, everybody. Gru, let's get focused. I think we need to get in the frame of mind for this podcast.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Adjust your karate gi, and let's take a deep breath in. Deep breath out. One more deep breath in.
I can't breathe that far, that deep, so...
Deep breath out. And let me say, no retreat!
No surrender!
Yes, everybody. It is Nothing Worthwhile presents Van Damme It, a podcast about Jean-Claude Van Damme, live via Zoom. Let's bring in my best friend, my partner in crime, Andrew Gruthius, on the southeast coast of the U.S., specifically Coral Springs, Florida. Gru, how the hell are you, my friend?
Good morning or good afternoon to you. To me, it's afternoon. I'm doing great. It's a nice three-day weekend.
Yes,
everything
is
good.
Yes,
it's a little nip in the air over the last week or so here in South Florida, which is
what constitutes a nip in the air? Like how cold?
Low 80s.
How cold is it?
No, I'm just kidding. No,
that was a good one.
No, it was this morning. Actually, it's Saturday. I had to get up early because I had to work at school for about 3 hours. So when I got up at like 7. It was literally 48 degrees outside. By the time I actually got outside, it was in the like high 50s, and it felt great. Like I was wearing it was morning on a weekend, so nobody's around. I'm wearing a hoodie, a sweatshirt, and it feels so damn comfortable. And then I go to the school, and I'm at the school for a couple hours, and I come out, and it's 80 fucking degrees, and I'm like, shit, it's hot, so. The weather's been kind of scattershot, but it's not 110 as it sometimes does get. So it's very comfortable right now.
Yeah. And it's funny you mention that, cause that's the same deal in Arizona. Like you can wake up and it's in the 40s, but by the time 3 o'clock hits, you literally it's in the 70s. You could be in a t-shirt and shorts. You start the day with like literally a winter coat. And then by the end of the day,
Why I put together my petition to start the work / school day at a nice, comfortable 11 a.m., 11:30, noon, go till like 2:30 and you're good. 3 hours. Come on.
I'm sure educational theorists have probably proposed something like that at some point.
Absolutely. Less is more. We always say less is more. How are you?
Absolutely.
How are you doing out there?
Everything. Well, the Moody family. It's always an interesting week. Weather a bit nippy. Marie's car didn't start this morning, so she's got the Moody mobile. So my car will get driven into the ground now, and she's at work. She's at work with Braxton. And
she took Doggy Shango to work with her. Is today take your dog to work day?
I'm not aware of that, but. Yes, she took boy. Last night, I put on, I thought, I'll throw this to you. I watched the first episode of Peacemaker, the HBO Max DC comic John Cena series.
How was that?
And I really super enjoyed it. And as I was thinking about this podcast, I just want to say again, I feel like, I don't know, maybe I'm a Cena mark, but I feel like in the acting world, similar to wrestling, the sky is the limit for this guy. I mean, this guy can really show some good range. I think you'll really like it. It's serious, but a little bit campy, like perhaps a comic series should be. Robert Patrick from T2 plays his father. Great.
Is it like adult? Is it adult oriented or is it like kind of like Marvel, where it's like PG-13-ish kind of?
I would say it's on the PG-13, slightly to the – you're going to get some a little bit of nudity, some sexual situations.
Hey, I'm
in.
There you go. That's all I need to do.
And you get some nice Easter eggs to perhaps the wider DC universe. Hmm. But I will definitely recommend John Cena, who we know is a wrestler. That would segue. Did you catch real quick SmackDown last night, Friday night?
No, I recorded it, so I plan on watching it this afternoon. I did not read what went down, but sounds like you did watch it. So should I or should I not?
You should.
Okay, good.
I was going to go to the second episode of Peacemaker, but I was like, of course I'm home on a Friday night with nothing to do, and of course Maria's out with her friends, and I'm sitting with Braxton. And I'm like, you know what? Damn it, I'm going to put on SmackDown Live, and I would give it a solid B rating.
Nice.
Show. I think you'll
big
segments.
I'm at the point where I watch them either on Hulu the next day, or I record them so I can scroll through stuff that really I don't like, and the commercials. So. Last night, I wanted to watch the premiere episode of the second season, speaking of DC, Superman and Lois on the CW.
You know, I never got into that. I know you recommend it. Maybe I got to give it a
shot. Yeah, you didn't like it?
No, I never watched it.
Oh, you didn't? I would start. You can get them all. I think you can get them all on HBO Max.
Okay.
But the second season so far, one episode up the stakes, and I really enjoy the show. They don't overdo it like you know, Justice League, and you know, everything is just, you might as well be in outer space. It's really kind of down to earth, it's a fun show. But I will also say this: you and I spoke during the week. I am really catching on to this MCU.
It's funny you mentioned that because I was at work and I was doing some paperwork. So I'm like, you know what? I'm going to go on the Last of the Action Heroes podcast network and listen to one of our old podcasts as I was doing some kind of paperwork. And I had it in one ear. And you go off on MCU. And then I had said to myself, the irony, because Andrew and I talked on Thursday and Andrew said, boy, I'm really starting to catch on to this MCU thing. I mean, I think you've actually, to be fair, trashed most of the MCU.
Really? I never.
Yes, because. No. Because you were
go
like.
Go ahead.
You were like, Evan, what I like about superhero movies is it's an ordinary man.
Yes, in an extraordinary way.
And then I said to you, I've heard that before. Yeah. And then I did like a trailer, an ordinary man.
Yeah.
And then you were laughing.
Actually, it's an extraordinary man in an ordinary world. Yeah, but you're 100% right.
I think the MCU movies sometimes are a bit much. I think there are certainly better ones that are better or classic than others, but I guess I like the special effects and I do like sort of the lore of the shared universe, but the floor is yours. Why have you come around on the MCU?
Because when I said those comments that I said, and I meant them at the time, that's how I felt, that it was just overblown, too much. But I said that without having seen Avengers Infinity War and Avengers Endgame, which I have watched over the past couple weeks more than once, both of them. And they are long movies. Because what I love about it is that it's really the human story that sort of carries through the entire universe. I really never kind of latched onto that before, and with those last two Avengers movies, they really do get to like what it's really all about, and it's really great writing, and it's great casting as well, and that's just stuff that I just didn't appreciate before that I really do now. And what it's forced me to do is go back into some of the ones that I hadn't seen, because I never hated or disliked the movies. I just had enough. I think that was it. I was like, all right, Age of Ultron, all right, I get it. Their team of superheroes, great. I'm good. But this is making me go into some of the ones that I hadn't seen, like Black Panther. I hadn't seen that. I have now. Mm-hmm. It's fantastic. I hadn't seen, there's all kinds of TV shows that I got to watch more TV. I really don't watch enough pop culture, but I have to say that, yes, at the time I felt that way, but I have since been rehabilitated in a way. Since then I saw Spider-Man No Way Home, which was very good. I don't think it's the biggest movie ever, like quality wise, that some people think it is. I think those other Avengers movies are better, but
well, I'm not going to see Spider-Man because Kim Kardashian fucking ruined it for me.
What do you mean?
Come on! You don't remember the week that was where people were Kardashian?
Oh yeah! I'm sorry.
That was going to be a fun insider reference in the Nothing Worthwhile universe
that I just ruined. But yeah, hey, look, people evolve, and I am evolving.
Yes, Howard. Yes, okay, thank you.
Well, very good.
Good. I am Howard Stern. I loved Infinity War. I liked Endgame. I want to watch the Hawkeye television series on Disney, Plus. Haven't gotten to it yet. Shang-Chi is on Disney Plus, and they just posted something else.
Maybe Eternals. I don't know. There's Eternals. Yes. There's WandaVision. Eternals, which, I mean, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, Eternals is now on, which I'll watch begrudgingly, but I know I'm going to hate it. But that's because I'm biased. But
what a cash! Know, what a cash cow! I was actually flipping through Disney Plus, the app on the thing, and I mean, when you talk about monopolies, I mean, Disney owns number one Disney. All right, that's yes. big enough. They've got Lucasfilm, which is all of Star Wars, all of Indiana Jones, plus Howard the Duck. They own they own Marvel, which is, you know, which is what it is. And they also own 20th Century Fox, which brings in all the – which is why now they can use Spider-Man and X-Men. What don't they own? I mean, Jesus Christ. Like, oh my God. So I guess it's like one – it's like Mickey Mouse is like controlling the entire world of movies and TV shows. Like, it's crazy. It really is. But, hey, the as long as the quality is there – keep going. And it's interesting because Disney can really learn something from watching, because it seems like Marvel, like, and the MCU, they're doing everything right that Star Wars did wrong. I could do a whole podcast on that, and maybe I will, maybe yeah, we will, we will in the future. But yeah, so just look, the bottom line is there's so much. Think of the amount of entertainment that's out there across all platforms. Like, we had five channels when we were kids. Our TVs went up to channel 13, and that was about it. And only like half of those channels actually worked. Look how far we've come. It's really amazing. It really is.
Yeah. Nothing Worthwhile brought to you by Disney Plus. all of the Moody and Gru on the yes, I absolutely agree. Gru, last month was S1 E3 episode for Nothing Worthwhile Presents Van Dammit, a podcast about Jean-Claude Van Damme as we front-kicked 1989's Kickboxer. Today we're going to discuss and break down Jean-Claude Van Damme's 1990 action flick, Lionheart.
Lionheart!
But first, let's check out the latest news on our favorite aging 80s-era action star. It's time for Van Dammit, Spanning the Universe.
Van Damme, Damme. Spanning the Universe. Yo!
Bruce, Spanning the Universe is brought to you by New You Life Center. Begin a new you. Check out all of their medical weight loss programs at www.newyoulifecenters.com or give them a call at 602-274-0068. Tell them Moody and Gru sent you and receive a big 15% off your first service. New You Life Center, we're in this journey together. A big Van Dammit thank you to New You Life Center. All right, Gru, we got a lot to lot of stuff to throw at you this
week.
Let's
span the universe.
Stallone, Gru, showbizcheatsheet.com posted this article this week that there was going to be a point where Sylvester Stallone meant for the Rocky franchise to end. Now, maybe you're aware of this, but this is the first time I actually read this. There was supposed to end definitively with Rocky V. According to Rocky V director John Avildsen, Rocky originally wasn't going to have any type of comeback after the fifth movie. That's because Stallone's decorated character wasn't supposed to live past the sequel. Quote, first of all, in V, Rocky was supposed to die, Avildsen said, according to CBSPhilly.com. At the end of the movie, he's on his way to the hospital. His head is in Adrian's lap, and he dies because he's taken a great beating from Tommy Gunn. Avildsen also had the aftermath of Rocky's death planned out. Quote, and the last scene of the movie, in the movie, Adrian comes out of the hospital and there's the world press assembled because Rocky is a big deal and she announces that he is dead. But as long as people believe in themselves, Rocky's spirit will live on forever. Studio interference made sure that that ending would never come to fruition. Apparently, you know, article goes on to say, hey, the studio said Rocky's not going to die. Batman doesn't die. Superman, James Bond, these people don't die. This resulted in a sequel that even Sylvester Stallone, you know, isn't too fond of. Ironically, even there were some rumors that Rocky was supposed to end at the fourth movie as well. Talking to Interview Magazine, Stallone felt that Rocky IV was as big as the series could get. When asked how many more Rocky movies he saw him tackling after four, Stallone seemed emphatic about his answer. Oh, this is it for Rocky. Because I don't know where you go after you battle Russia. You know what I mean? You have that clash of ideologies, and you take on supposedly the greatest fighting machine ever. Gru, Creed is the first film in the Rocky series that Stallone did not write. Stallone explained that it was the director, Ryan Coogler, who approached Stallone with a new take, continuing the franchise. Quote, a young filmmaker came to me. I have an idea. Apollo Creed having an illegitimate son. Quote, Stallone, the perfect guy, didn't always walk the walk, Stallone said on The Ellen Show. Coogler wasn't the only person to offer ideas for a Rocky sequel. Ironically, while talking in the interview, Stallone revealed that people pitch him Rocky sequels all the time. Quote, and then you know what? You listen to them, and then an hour later, their lawyer calls you and sues you. Gru, I myself was not aware of the pitched Rocky demise in number five. Should have happened, should have not have happened. Andrew Gruthius, you report, and of course, I will decide.
Yes, I was aware of that part of it, that they wanted to, that both Stallone and Avildsen wanted Rocky to die. And I've heard that description of it, and I'm, even though the movie sucked either way, I'm glad they didn't do that. Even if they did do it, they'd still be able to bring him back, because they just do that anyway. But it's just so silly. But the whole movie was so silly at that point anyway. So, but I'm glad they didn't do it. And look, you have to remember, Rocky, with the Rocky movies, you have Rocky in 76. Then 3 years later, you got Rocky II in 79. 3 years after that, you got Rocky III in 82. And then 3 years after that, in 85, you got Rocky IV. So, yes, I do remember that Rocky IV was supposed to be the last one. Hence the reason why it wasn't another 4 or 5 years until Rocky V. And that turned out to be a train wreck. But you got to remember where Stallone was at the time. Stallone was still, after Rocky IV, he was the biggest star in the world. And so when you're the biggest star in the world, you think, okay, I can retire this and go do the art films that I want to do. I can go do comedy. I can go do this. Well, guess what? A few years later, Stallone wasn't so hot anymore. So he found the only way to come back was to bring back what worked. And that plan worked. And that's going to happen to everybody. It's going to happen to – it's happening right now to Hugh Jackman, who said with Logan he was never going to play Wolverine anymore. Well, how many huge hits has Hugh Jackman had since X-Men? You know, not that many. And now I'm hearing
– what? Wait, you didn't like the whatever, the Greatest Showman movie?
I didn't see it, but I don't hear much about it. But my point is, now we're hearing, five, six years after Logan, we're hearing that Hugh Jackman is unretiring his Wolverine, which is perfectly fine. Yeah, I don't know exactly how or when or where. Michael Keaton coming back to Batman. You know, these guys always, you know, when they find a nice high money paying gig that won't hurt their careers, that they think could put them in a certain position. Absolutely. Why not? So you never say never. And Stallone never said never. Nobody ever says never. And I'm glad, because Rocky Balboa, as you know, we both love that. And the Creed movie, yes. The Creed movies speak for themselves. I do think, Stallone wrote the second one, or at least part of it. But I know you're right about he did not write the first one, and they're both really well done. So as long as the quality is there and it's not, you know, it's not a mockery of itself, keep bringing back these characters. They still endear and they're still great. And as long as they're still good, as long as there's still life in them, let's go.
Agree with you on the Stallone take on Creed. Creed 1 was epic. Creed 2 was very good, but Creed 1 was epic. And on the Hugh Jackman, I really hope he doesn't, because I super loved Logan. I really liked
it.
I thought it was like literally Oscar worthy performance.
I agree.
I really thought that was a fitting way to close it out, and I just hope they don't.
The only reason that I disagree with you on that one, in that I'd like to see more, is because I've always said that Hugh Jackman as Wolverine is one of the great casting things of in history to me. Like, I really don't think I could accept anybody else as Wolverine. It's just, he just owns that character. I think I said this last time, in a Rocky prequel. There's only one Rocky, you know, and that's Sylvester Stallone. I mean, that's just the way I see it. Like someone like Iron Man, you can get away with it. What? I'm just saying. Someone like Iron Man or Spider-Man. Well, because half the time they're covered in a mask, so it doesn't really matter who's underneath, you know. So
yeah, I guess with this whole multiverse they could do it, but I'm not going to like it, and but anyway, let's go. All right. Fuck it. Let's move on.
Great
Arnold
segue.
Schwarzenegger. Arnold Schwarzenegger grew. Jamie Lee Curtis and Arnold Schwarzenegger were the only celebrities to turn up on the Golden Globes this year amid the controversy of the Hollywood Foreign Press's diversity and practices. The January 9th ceremony was a non-televised private event. Boy, how the mighty have fallen.
Yeah.
With the HFPA saying that no celebrities were invited. Many famous faces have spoken out against the organization, notably after it was revealed that no black people were active in the Hollywood Foreign Press Association. Scarlett Johansson has also alleged that she faced sexist questions and remarks by certain HFPA members that were bordered on sexual harassment. However, during the private event, Hollywood's Halloween star Jamie Lee Curtis appeared in a pre-recorded clip as she praised the Hollywood Foreign Press philanthropic work. Arnold Schwarzenegger also appeared in the clip praising the organization, saying they understand that to support the arts and creativity, one must cultivate new diverse voices from all walks of life and all corners of the globe. I was one of their beneficiaries.
That's and very good.
HFPA President Helen Hone, H-O-E-H-N-E, recently spoke about the organization's efforts to change, telling Sky News, the HFPA really has worked very hard over the last 9 months to reform the organization from top to bottom. There are now people of color included or involved in every decision-making facet of the organization. Gru, The Power of the Dog and West Side Story were the big film winners at this year's Golden Globes, taking home the respective Best Motion Picture Drama and Comedy or Musical prizes, as well as a handful of other awards. Succession, which I actually really like, came out on top on the TV side of things, taking home 3 awards, including Best Drama, Best Actor in a Drama for Jeremy Strong, and Best Supporting Actress for Sarah Snook. Gru, Arnie, at a very sparse, non-televised Golden Globes, what are your thoughts?
Well, I applaud Arnold Schwarzenegger and Jamie Lee. I thought you were talking about a True Lies 2 or something. But I applaud them for doing what they did. I really can't stand it when, you know, Hollywood wants to pretend that they're, you know, all of a sudden they give a shit. They don't. Just like everybody else. If the Hollywood Foreign Press, whatever that is, the whole joke about them is that nobody really knows what or who it is, but apparently they do know who it is. It's just another one of those things where, to me, it's the same thing when people talk about, well, why isn't there diversity in the nominees, or why is it all white directors who are nominated this year? Well, maybe those were the best movies of the year. Like, is it possible? Okay. You know, like, is it possible that? Do they really think that the Hollywood Foreign Press Association has decided they're not going to have any minorities in their governing body? I highly doubt that. It's just everybody is now pointing fingers to whoever's not. I don't know. I gotta find a way to say this without sounding offensive, because I'm all for diversity, but not like. How do I say this without getting in trouble?
Let me frame it this way. Would you consider what Arnie and Jamie Lee did courageous in lieu of like this mass action against Hollywood foreign press, or stupid, or maybe a little bit of both?
Neither, because I think both of them at this point in their careers, there are some people who are kind of untouchable. I mean, to a certain point, they made sure that they were, you know, they were very careful with their words. That was for sure. But maybe a little courageous in that everybody else was backing off, and they said, you know what, we're, instead of throwing the baby out with the bathwater, we're going to treat this as an organization that needs some reform, but we're not going to ignore it. And that's what everybody else did. Everybody just decided to ignore it. And they say, hey, look at me. I am a big-time Hollywood star, and I am turning down the opportunity for an award to protest this, that, the other thing. Do you remember when Marlon Brando won the Best Actor for The Godfather in 1972, and instead of accepting the award, a Native American came up and accepted it for him and said, Mr. Brando has to return this award because of the treatment of Native Americans, and everybody booed her ass off the stage? She'd get a standing ovation today, wouldn't she? You know what I mean?
Okay. Yeah, well, hold on. Let me take a breath.
Am I in trouble now?
Years old,
do I have to censor this?
No. What I would say is back in 1972, there seemed to be an authenticity to things of that nature. And I think actually back at the time, Marlon Brando was probably kind of considered a little bit of a blowhard, you know, at that point. I definitely read about it, but there seemed to be more of an authenticity back in the day when people protested or people brought up causes. Now, the thing I agree with everything you said, except the notion that Arnie is perhaps untouchable, because I don't think anyone's untouchable anymore.
I said
because
to
you
a
might
point.
Say that. Okay, you might say that Arnie's perhaps majority of his film career is pretty much wrapped up, and you know he certainly made millions, if not, I don't know. Okay, so let's just say that. You know, like I look at the situation with Chris Noth, like he was in the whatever the Sex and the City television sequel. And he's 63, older fella, not ancient, but he's an older fella. And now you have an instance where five women have come out and made sexual assault allegations to some form or fashion. He was booted from The Equalizer, and they've already edited, apparently, his scenes out of the HBO Max television show. But what really caught my eye was, as I was doing a little bit of the research for the podcast, there was an article about his wife was seen in a car crying without her wedding band. And my thing is, you know, when this stuff comes out, and perhaps nothing will ever come of it with Chris Noth in terms of a legal action, this guy's going to be persona non grata, and he won't be able to go out, per se, and have dinner anymore without people either looking or provoking him. So even that with Arnold, I mean, you know, we'll talk about Steven Seagal because I have an article that references a little bit of that kind of stuff. So, I don't know. I probably have gotten off kilter, but
no,
that would be
because I think it's important. Because as far as Chris Noth is concerned, it's basically an example of the fact that there really is no due process in this country anymore.
I agree.
Because I know we'll probably get to this in something that you're going to talk about. I believe everybody has the right to work and earn a living, and what's interesting about this situation is that it was because this guy's been on TV screens for the last 30 years. He's been in 20 different Law and Orders. He was a huge thing on the first Sex and the City thing, even though I haven't seen 1 minute of one episode of that series or the new one. But all of a sudden, he's in the news because, spoiler alert, in the first episode, apparently, of this new series, his character dies. So he's in the news, and he makes headlines, and all of a sudden, these women from former lives come off and say, oh, yeah, by the way, this guy is a prick who sexually assaults women. Like, that's the problem. And then he's off that show. He's off every show. He can't walk out. Like, all you have to do is say something. Like, even if it's 20 years later. And you know what? I said the same thing about Bill Cosby when it happened. And Bill Cosby was completely canceled, and I felt that that was wrong until he had his day. He had his day. He was found guilty, and then I'm like, okay, there you go. Now, he should be in prison. Okay? He's been found guilty by a jury of his peers. No more work for you. You lose your token. But no such luck for somebody like Noth or Kevin Spacey or any of these other people who have been, quote-unquote, canceled by this culture. Now, with Arnold Schwarzenegger, and I promise I'll stop after this, Schwarzenegger thing, what I meant by untouched, untouchable, obviously if Arnold Schwarzenegger goes and poisons some women's drink, and that, you know, that's that's a little different. But him speaking out about the Hollywood Foreign Press, that's not something that's going to bring him down, not him. Maybe it would bring somebody like Timothy Chalamet down, you know, who's just starting. But Schwarzenegger has been there, done that, his share of controversy. Former governor, he could do whatever he wants.
Timothy Chalamet?
No,
Schwarzenegger. Never heard of him.
Yes, you have. You saw Dune. Did you
I
see
know.
Dune?
It's a jump. I didn't see the new Dune.
I didn't see it either. I just figured everybody else
did. If I had 2.5 hours to kill, I would gladly see it. But it didn't really interest me.
It doesn't interest me either, but I heard it was good. But
all right.
Anyway, let me say, if I offended anybody with that last thing, you got to be careful now. You know.
All right. Well, okay. Let me just say this: nothing worthwhile does not condone the comments recently made by Andrew Guthias and Evan Moody Association Core.
Nothing worthwhile LLP.
Yeah, right.
Limited.
Gru, let's move on to Mr. Bruce Willis. Gru, on Wednesday, the Bruce Meister, Bruce Willis, released yet another straight-to-VOD film that was absolutely ravaged by the critics. It's called The Killing Field. Gru, here is the trailer. Let me please share sound. Let me talk this up here for a second. Let me get back to my notes. All right, crew, here is the trailer starring one Bruce Willis. This is The Killing Field. Here is the British UK trailer for the new Bruce Willis straight to VOD, The Killing Field.
Get the door!
Gee, it looks so different than every other movie ever made.
Detective Watson, so nice to finally make your acquaintance.
Why are you wasting my time?
You're my prisoner until my boss gets here. I hear you two have quite a history.
You belong to me now, Cupcake.
I can't wait to see your face.
I'm gonna be the guy that's gonna kill you.
I got shot today.
And you still hit like a bitch.
To give another apology.
This is my farm.
You notice how...
Hold on. Oh, hold on. Son of a bastard. Gru, Killing Field pits two cops, one being Willis, the other one bereaved war veteran played by Chad Michael Murray, against an eclectic assortment of drug smuggling miscreants in a semi-tropical rural locale somewhere in the southern U.S. Gru, Killing Field is released on January 17th on all digital platforms. Now, Andrew, any thoughts on the new Bruce Willis Killing Field?
Did you notice that in every clip in that trailer that Bruce was in, he was wearing the same clothes?
I also noticed he's sitting quite a bit.
Yes, because that's probably – they probably showed every scene that he's in the movie in that trailer. Because the way he's brilliant. And it's not just him. It's him. I think Steven Seagal actually invented this business type thing. Him, Nicolas Cage, John Travolta, and Steven Seagal have this thing where they're literally paid – millions, you know, not like 20, 30 million, but maybe like $3, $4, $5 million to literally show up in one of these foreign productions for two to three days at the most, phone in a thing, and part of that deal is that they get on the post, they can advertise it as a Bruce Willis movie or a Steven Seagal movie or a Nicolas Cage movie, and it will break the bank in foreign markets. And the reason that these guys do it is because they know that nobody in the United States will ever see these movies. And that, you know, if you notice, I think Chad Michael Murray's name is first in the credits, because I think that's part of it. They don't want to misrepresent the fact, or at least completely, that Bruce Willis is the star of the movie. He's not. You know, so that's how these things work. I've never seen one of them. Not one. Because most of them suck, and they will, and these actors will attest to that. They probably won't. Bruce Willis probably can't even name five of these that he's done, because he spends literally no time doing it. He's working off his name. It's nothing anybody else wouldn't do. Eventually, he'll want to do Die Hard again, and people will go to see that if it's any good. But these guys, when they feel their box office mojo slipping, they have to find ways to make a solid living, and that's and these VOD things that are big hit, they make money. You're so enthralled by this. I'm just telling you how it works.
It sounds like quantity over quality.
That's exactly what it is. Except there's very little quantity when you get to it, because if you actually are bored enough to pay $1.99 to watch that thing, you'd see that Willis is probably dead before the end credits. You know, like, I mean, that's how these things work.
And these schlock films do well in foreign markets?
Yes, they do, because of the star power. They love American stars. Like, I'll give you one quick example of how I learned this. When I worked for Harvey Keitel, all right, in America, he's not that big of a superstar anymore. He was never really an A-lister here, but I've traveled all around with him. And I walk the streets in New York with him, and nobody bothers him. But when we go to Europe, he needs escort, because everybody loves him. Like, these people are so idolized across the pond. It surprised me, and now I get why they do this kind of work. They make a lot of money. These little foreign movie companies, they have boatloads of cash. And they spend it wisely.
When you were across the pond, as you quote-unquote said, did any females throw themselves at you to get access to one Harvey Keitel?
Blink twice
for yes. Okay, thank you. Let's move on. Speaking of, you mentioned Steven Seagal, a little bit more of a serious article. Gru, Steven Seagal's ex-wife is back in the limelight, so to speak, and she's talking about her famous ex, Kelly LeBrock. Mm. Boy, she was quite a beauty in the day.
She was.
She, quote, pities her controversial ex-husband, Steven Seagal, dubbing him a Hollywood tragedy. Quote, I feel sorry for the man, the actress, 61, told Page Six in a recent interview of Seagal, who has been accused by many women of sexual misconduct spanning decades. Quote, I think he's just a very sad person, and he is what I would call a tragedy of Hollywood. Gru, Seagal and LeBrock were married from 1987 to 1996, excuse me, and shared three children together, daughters Annalisa and Arisa and son Dominic. Seagal, 69. A martial arts instructor turned action star, has been mired in controversy for years. In 2018, and Andrew has referenced this before, two women accused the actor of sexual assault, one allegedly occurring way back in 1993 and the other in 2002. But both cases fell outside the statute of limitations and no charges were filed. A group of 11 other women, including actresses Jenny McCarthy, Portia de Rossi, and Juliana Margulies, some pretty big names, have also accused the actor of sexual misconduct. Gru, Seagal has also has Serbian and Russian citizenship and is a staunch supporter of Vladimir Putin. In 2018, he was appointed by Russia as a special envoy for humanitarian ties to the U.S. After LeBrock divorced Seagal, she left Hollywood behind to live on a ranch in California's Santa Ynez Valley. Quote, you know, I was just never impressed with being famous or fabulous. She stated, I got up every day and did my job. I didn't think about being a pretty lady or any of that nonsense.
Bullshit!
LeBrock had a contract with Christian Dior and the infamous Pantene commercial in which she intoned, don't hate me just because I'm beautiful. I didn't hate it, she said in the 80s ad, which became a pop culture phenomenon. I just thought it was ridiculous. Gru, Kelly Brock went to star in The Woman in Red opposite Gene Wilder and the John Hughes teen comedy, which was a good one, Weird Science. After a very lengthy sabbatical, Kelly LeBrock is back on screen playing a gangster's ex-wife in the comedy Tomorrow's Today, but she's not sure if she's back in Hollywood to stay. Who knows? Quite honestly, I just want to get married and stay home. Gru, very telling comments about Steven Seagal from someone who knows him quite well.
Yeah.
Thoughts?
Well, yeah, if you want to get married and stay home and have a private life, definitely go to a big publication and do a big interview and get on all the headlines. Look, wow. Kelly LeBrock was beautiful. I don't buy it for a second that she didn't want to be the number one hot whatever. So I think what she's saying is covering up the fact that she never really made it to where she wanted to get to. Seagal, on the other hand, look, I don't feel bad for Seagal. He, like I said, he's making millions after millions after millions on all of these movies that every other country in the world besides us rushes out to see because he's still very popular all over the world. The world is much bigger than the United States. He's always been known to be crazy. You read these stories about his Saturday Night Live appearance. Like, he's a
douche. Okay,
hold on.
He's a douche. But there's crazy, and then there's breaking the law.
Okay, yeah. I would say, I got to be careful. Because
sour shoes, I want you to go to jail.
When you talk about breaking the law, okay, there's a lot of ex post facto going on in the world today. Meaning that a lot of what was acceptable then is not acceptable now. Now, it's never acceptable to break the law, but what are you doing?
Hello, Mark. Please, Mark.
He's calling his lawyer.
What is the definition of ex post facto?
You know what that means.
I'm joking.
You know what that means. It's like all these people getting busted for all these baseball players getting busted for steroids for doing it back when it was legal.
Let me ask you a question, though. Why the anger at Kelly LeBrock?
Me? I don't have any anger for Kelly LeBrock.
Well, you seem to be a little bit...
I just don't like it when people do that. It's like there's no reason. Number one, he's the father of her kids, or at least one of them.
Okay.
It's just uncool to do that. If you're sad for the guy, why don't you tell him instead of telling the world? What are you... You got some kind of goal here. All right? So, you know, I don't buy that. Is he a sad guy? Probably. If you're going to do shit like he's done, he's probably got a lot of screws loose. Is he an entertaining guy? Yes. Would I watch any of the movies that he's been making lately? No. But if he does Under Siege 3, I'll be first in line. I loved his like first four or five, and then he started. Then he saw that there was more money. Number one, he saw that his reputation was hurting him in Hollywood. So he got on the bandwagon early with these foreign markets, and he does whatever he wants. He did a TV show where he was like a fictionalized version of himself as like a New Orleans cop. He does whatever he wants. So I don't think I'm sad for him as far as professionally. Personally, he's like most of these people. He's probably a miserable guy. So, yeah, I'm sorry for him in that way. But career-wise, he's don't cry for him, Argentina. He's doing just fine.
I agree with some of what you said about Kelly LeBrock. I mean, certainly anytime anyone goes to the press, there's an endgame.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be quite as harsh. You know, 11 women making accusations on sexual misconduct, and I'm not trying to – I don't believe in the cancel culture. I'm not for it. I'm not for a lot of things, but I do say in life where there's smoke, there's fire. You said to me one actress, two okay, maybe there's a little bit of, you know, when you say 11, there's got to be something there. And I don't know. I don't know if I'd go see an Under Siege 3. I'm by no means a highly moral, principled guy. I'm ethically flawed and morally flawed like everybody else. But
let me ask you a question.
It kind of sounds like a vomit, similar to – all right, go ahead.
Yeah, I think he's a low life of a person, but as far as I can tell. But here's the thing. Let me ask you this. Do you ever, and if you don't want to answer, I'll answer, but if you don't want to answer, I understand why. Do you ever look back on your life and think about things that you might have said or done as far as women are concerned and think, ooh, if I did that today or if I said that today, it wouldn't be kosher? Do you ever reflect like that?
Hit pause? No, I'm joking. No. Yes.
So do I. And I will bet that if I were famous, there would be a couple of people who said I said or inferred something at some point within the last 35 years that could be considered, not acceptable today. I'll bet that would happen.
I'm probably sure I put my foot in my mouth many a times. In terms of physical interactions, I'd like to think that I've hopefully been a gentleman the majority of my life and didn't do anything. But I'll just leave it at that.
Well, look, I have 7 restraining orders, so that will tell you. No, I'm just kidding about that. Only 3. I think that all of this. Do you see some kind of reckoning coming, or is it just going to keep getting so we can't even speak anymore? Everybody has to carry around some kind of thing where if they're about to say something weird, they get buzzed or something so they can't say it. Where is the end game here, or is there one?
I don't think American society is going to get to that level. I think you might see a little bit of a balancing back towards the center, but no, it's, as my dad always says, once it goes past that tug of war line, it very rarely comes back. So I think you're going to see perhaps a little, you're going to see a little bit back to the center. Cause we've had guys like Chappelle and we talked about Louis C.K. that have sort of, they've tried to cancel them and they keep on going and their attitude is, I'll be damned. They're also at least I would think a guy like Chappelle is also at a position of strength because, he's had a ridiculously very successful career and probably is going to hedge his bet that if he gets canceled, he could probably just go to his home in Ohio and live out the rest of his life pretty happy with his money. In terms of your end game, I don't think it's going to get to that level, but I mean, yes, everybody has to be so absolutely careful, especially celebrities, especially politicians. Sometimes I think it's fair because maybe their reckoning was coming, and sometimes I think it's patently unfair.
Yeah, it's interesting about Dave Chappelle, though, because what was proven, at least to me, about Dave Chappelle is that we can say all these things, all this innuendo about what these people say and do and whatever. When you finally get the actual physical truth, it's always different than what it actually is. What Dave Chappelle did and said on that special that everybody was so up in arms about was very smart and very learned and not transphobic at all. It was simply discussing. Yeah, go ahead.
I agree with you, but again, that's a matter of opinion. So, people are highly sensitive and it's really, really, taken out of control. What he said, that's a matter of opinion.
No, but is it a matter of opinion when you're identifying something as transphobic or anything phobic that has a specific definition and it's just not that? Transphobic is fear of trans people. Okay?
Yeah,
it was not that. The definition does not support what Dave Chappelle said or did.
Here's what I'll say about that. Mm-hmm. I don't want to go down some rabbit hole. I don't think what he said was transphobic, and I think comedy, making a joke about something, does not equate hatred.
Correct. Right?
So, you know, we could goof on racial norms, we could goof on cultural gender, we could goof on the news, we could, and making a joke about somebody doesn't equate to hatred. But that's just my opinion. Other people really don't feel the same way, and I think it's a shame. And that's pretty much what I'll say about Dave Chappelle. I think he has, I hope he continues, because I find him funny and I enjoy him. If somebody else got canceled that I didn't care about, I really wouldn't care.
The ironic thing is, I used to not like Chappelle. And in this new phase of his career where he's really being sort of topical, I find him much, much funnier than I used to.
Well, then you need to go back and watch his comedy.
I mean stand-up. No, Chappelle's show was great. I'm talking about just his stand-up. You know what I mean?
Well, let's get to this. Let's take a breath. Let's take a breath in. Breath out. We know that the last of the Action Heroes podcast network is adding a Mel Gibson podcast. We ready to go down this final item?
Let's do it.
All right. The Atlantic published an article. It was a month ago, and I don't know anything about the Atlantic. I don't know if it's a liberal, conservative. I don't really care. Posted an article entitled "Cancel Mel Gibson: Why Is Hollywood Still Hiring This Raging Anti-Semite?" So I got a lot, but I'm just going to try to bullet it, so I'm not talking for 10 minutes. The article goes on to say that the author experienced a sense of bemusement when they went on the Deadline website to read Mel Gibson in talks to direct Lethal Weapon 5. Article goes on to say that Gibson, the author calls Gibson a well-known Jew hater. His prejudices are well documented. He enjoyed the Lethal Weapon movies, loves Danny Glover, and admits that Mel Gibson is a talented man, but states that many horrible people, many talented people produce wonderful art. Many horrible people produce wonderful art. And says, you know, if a guy like Mel Gibson can still find big bucks in Hollywood, cancel culture, quote, does not exist. He talks about that Mel Gibson's reported anti-Semitism, that this doesn't seem to bother the executives at Warner Brothers, who I guess is behind the Lethal Weapon series, quote, saying perhaps Jews don't count. David Baddiel is the author, who's a British Jew, argues that in polite society treats anti-Semitism as a semi-acceptable form of prejudice. And I agree with that.
Can you repeat that again, please?
He argues that polite society treats anti-Semitism as one of the last semi-acceptable forms of prejudice.
Okay.
May I go on?
Yeah, no, I didn't hear it. That's why I wanted you to repeat it.
He goes on to say that in Hollywood, which is very much a liberal town, the progressive left often seems to tolerate and at times seems to produce anti-Semitism. He talks about the last couple of years, all of the massacres and all the, the massacres of Jewish people. There was the Tree of Life massacre in Pittsburgh, the murder at the Shabbat of Poway Synagogue in California, Jewish students harassed on college campuses, European anti-Semitism on the rise. He goes on to talk about Mel Gibson, that quote, Winona Ryder said that she was asked by Mel Gibson if she was an oven dodger at a party. He also wrote Passion of the Christ, which is a film that got the Rotten Tomatoes highest audience score for a film in Aramaic. I think that was the language of the film. But he quotes Passion of the Christ as a gleeful attack on Jews, portraying Jews as eager Christ killers, a libel that has been an excuse to torment and murder Jews for 2,000 years. I don't agree with his take on his films. He said, let's look at Gibson's arrest record in 2006. We know that Mel was pulled over for drunk driving. In the back of the police car, he was quoted on tape as saying, asking if the officer was Jewish, and quote, saying, fucking Jews. Quote, the Jews are responsible for all the wars in the world. Mel later claimed that he was under the influence and said things that he does not believe. I will, if you don't believe about his police record, he has recordings on tape with his, the mother of his child, Oksana Grigoria, who was on fellow Jew Howard Stern show, and they released these tapes. Lowlifes include Gibson telling Gregoria, if you get raped by a pack of N-words, it'll be your fault. And shut the F up. You should just fucking smile and blow me. That's, of course, is a favorite, famous tape.
Yeah.
Mel Gibson also pleaded no contest to the charge of domestic battery against Gregoria in 2011. How can Warner Brothers, a company founded by Jews, possibly consider hiring this man on its parent company's website? It has an inclusion policy that reads, Warner Brothers Media is committed to diversity, equity, and inclusion as moral and business imperatives. It is essential that our workforce, content, and creative partners reflect diversity of our society and the world around us. The author goes on to say, how about a, an equally robust exclusion policy? How about don't hire racist, anti-Semite, misogynists? He also talks about that there's rumors that Mel Gibson will star in a John Wick origin series for Starz and Liongate Television. How did this guy become such a hot ticket again? Is it just that the memories of his hate speech have faded? He goes on a long rant and finishes by saying, I believe in this cancel culture I keep reading about so much, and I also believe that Jews do in fact count. And the reason why I brought this up is, yes, our own podcast network is starting a new Mel Gibson podcast, which I have some things to say about this. Not really a sort of current events article on Mel Gibson, but more an op-ed. I've said enough. I'll take a breath and take a swig of water, Andrew. Article lays out a whole sort of like a court case against Mel Gibson. What are your thoughts?
This is a tough one. I agree with a lot of what the article said. Now, just to preface this, the article, I've read the article. The article, the guy who wrote the article is referencing an actor who wrote his own article. His name is Joshua Molina, who is sort of a well-known character actor in the United States.
As I explained to you, this is written by a British Jew.
No.
I don't know if it was referencing somebody.
No, it was, because I have it in front of me.
All right.
And it made headlines back a month ago when the actor did it, when he wrote it. Now, this is an actor, part of the same community that Mel Gibson is in. They probably live in the same town. So that's, that's him talking about that. He is a Jew, and he's often cast in Jewish roles, and he's a terrific actor. I agree with him that this needs to be there needs to be a discussion, and it needs to be out there. At the same time, I've always said this. There comes a time when you have to I think you need to separate the man from their work, because here's the thing. And I said, I got to be careful again. Let me give you an example. I stumbled upon last week an old episode of The Cosby Show. Okay? And I just decided to watch it. The dude was fucking funny. All right? So, do I know that he is an absolute scumbag who should be still in prison? Absolutely. But that doesn't mean I'm not going to watch his old stuff. I feel the same way about somebody like Michael Jackson. You know, if a Michael Jackson song comes on and it's one of the ones I like, I'm going to listen to it. Do I believe that he was a child molester? I do. But that does not affect the music to me. Now, let me ask you this. Should it? Because I really don't know the answer to that question. I think everybody has the right to work and earn a living in their field unless they are, by due process, not permitted to do so. Unless they have violated specific areas of the law that do not allow them to continue what they've been doing. Now, the one question I would ask the people that wrote this article is, how do they feel about Roman Polanski? Are there two different standards here? Are sexual assault, are people who have been convicted of sexual assault the same as people who have anti-Semitic thoughts? Maybe, maybe not. But
So
I just want to make sure that I put the cap on what I said. So I just want to say one more thing. I am a fan of not Mel Gibson, the man, or even the actor. I am a fan of a lot of the movies that he's made, and that will not change because the work is the work. Have I seen a Mel Gibson movie in the theater since this whole thing happened? No. If a Lethal Weapon 5 came out, would I go? Yes. And that's where I am. Do I think he's an anti-Semitic bastard? Yes, I do.
Okay. Let me break down a couple of your comments. To the Roman Polanski thing, I think that's a deflection. I mean, the guy is writing a specific op-ed piece about anti-Semitism and Mel Gibson.
That's true. All right, good point.
Roman Polanski, you'd have to write another article. I mean, the guy is apparently a rapist, and, I think the fact that Hollywood, to some level, had him still working throughout his entire career.
They gave him an Oscar.
Is pretty disgusting. I guess it shows that commerce really, you talk about this very, Hollywood's supposed to be a very in tune politically, very politically correct, very liberal. And I guess really what really trumps on not every single situation, but that's the almighty dollar. Now, to this piece, I hear exactly what you're saying, and I probably don't disagree with it, but I'm a Jew.
So am I.
I don't go to temple.
Neither do I.
I'm not some, guy who's super into it, but I'm super into the culture, and I won't go to see Lethal Weapon 5 with Mel Gibson. And when I first read this, and I was so angry, and I was thinking about it, and I'm like, I'm going to go scorched earth on, the podcast, and they're starting to Mel. No, I'm not going to do that. But what I would say to Ryan and I think the guy's name Cisco, who's doing the Mel Gibson podcast. I mean, that's on you guys. That's on you guys. And you could, celebrate his works and things of that nature. That's not going to go away. But I think the guy's, a piece of shit. And I won't be listening to the Mel Gibson podcast. That's
well, he's definitely a piece of shit. I think the podcasts, all of these podcasts are really, they're talking about the work of the person, not the person themselves. I certainly understand your position, and I think I agree with it, probably for different reasons, and I'm sort of ashamed to admit that. But
why? Why are you ashamed?
Well, because, again, just like the anti-Semitism is not going to it'll keep me – like if you asked me would I want to meet Mel Gibson, I would say yes so I could punch him in the face. I wouldn't say – yeah. I wouldn't say yes, I'd like to have dinner with him. No, I don't want to be anywhere near that guy. But does it make me a hypocrite if I can still enjoy the movies? Does it? I don't know.
It's a tough call.
Like, because if they're doing a podcast on the movie Forever Young with Mel Gibson and I forgot who else was in it. I didn't like that movie, so I'm not going to listen to that podcast. However, if they're doing one on Lethal Weapon 2, I'll probably listen because that's one of my favorite movies. So I don't know where the line is. I'll end this by saying one thing that I definitely disagree with that article on. I don't know if they saw The Passion of the Christ. I did. I went to see it actually in the movies when it came out because I wanted to go after it. I heard about it. I said, all right, I'm going to find this guy's going to be proving to me that he is a fucking scumbag. That movie's a really good movie, and it does not, in my opinion, portray Jews the way they are saying it does. That's what I've only seen it once, so maybe I got to see it again. But I remember feeling that way when I saw it. And I said, this did not feel or seem anti-Semitic in any way. It was a very straightforward telling of the same story that we've heard many times. And it was very, very well done, the movie. I just disagree that it does what they say it does.
That's fair to disagree, but and I saw it a long time ago. The author's not saying it's not a quality movie, but I'm going to tell you that for every person who said no, there's 15 reviews, 15 articles that said that movie trashes Jews. And
I will take that, and I will. Should I watch it again, or does it not even matter at this point?
I mean, you know, we're such a laissez-faire people. Like, we just get beaten up in the media and beaten up, and you know, it's just like, you know what?
But we do it to ourselves. That's the.
I don't want to get into this whole
thing. I think it's important to discuss because, you know, this is not going away. This, as you reporting on this story, is proof enough that this stuff is not going away. It's the only way for it to get better is to have discussions and to be able to talk about it without fear of boredom or without fear of retribution. I think it's important to talk about these things and answer these questions. Is it right or wrong? Or is everybody free to make their own decisions?
Gru and I are going to be on a Fresh Air, NPR's podcast, to discuss.
I think it's important. No, this is
all right. All right, but let's. I don't want to go. You know,
I want your opinion, though. I want your opinion. My opinion.
What's?
I asked you. I said, does it make, like, you know me? I'm Jewish. You know, I'm not anti-Semitic in any way. Okay? You know that much about me. If you didn't know me that well, this is a hard question to ask, but if you didn't know me that well and I told you, yeah, I just saw Passion of the Christ, what an incredible movie, Gibson's an amazing director, would you think I was anti-Semitic if you didn't know me, or if you didn't know me as well?
How could I make that extrapolation?
Okay. All right, so the answer is that me enjoying that, knowing that the auteur is anti-Semitic, does me enjoying that make me part of the problem?
No, what I said was and I don't. Again, I want to move on to Lionheart, and I want to get into some fun stuff. But you said you had seen the movie, and you admitted a while ago, but you did not take the movie to be some kind of a trashing or anti-Semitic tropes in the movie. I said to you, I've also seen it a long time ago. I don't remember it, but for every person, you know, for every person who says no, it wasn't that bad. There's, you know, you can find in, you know, Reddit and this, that, you know, 1,000 posts of people saying it trashes Jewish people. That's all.
So then let's forget about that one for a moment, because that's, the jury's still out. Let's go to Lethal Weapon. You said you would not go see it. I said I would. What is it that you know that I don't seem to know?
I don't know. I'm not claiming I know anything, Andrew. I'm just saying, for my sensibility, I just, you know, I would rather not see the movie. It's just where I'm at 51 years old. I mean, every day the news, you got the killing Israel. I'm tired of it. I'm tired of it. And I think as a people,
yeah, I wish the people who were doing it would get tired of it also. But
all right, well, you know, but listen, it's interesting. My bottom line for me is, I will not deny anybody to do a podcast about any person or anything like that. But what I'm saying for me is that's on them. He's an avowed anti-Semite. He's a guy with a very troubled, checkered past. That's on them. That's all I'm saying. I'm not listening to the podcast, but they certainly have a right to do the podcast. And that's all I'm saying about that. And let's start a podcast war. I'm joking.
I think we just did.
All right. Can we move on?
Yeah. Yeah. I want to make sure that I don't get in any kind of trouble.
Let's take a drink. Did we say anything that should?
I don't know. At this point, these days, who the hell knows? I mean, six years ago, I told a coworker that she looked really good that day. Am I going to start hearing about that now? Like, I might. You never know. That's why you got to be so careful, and that's why the truth does. That's why the truth is so elusive, because everybody jumps to so many fucking conclusions. Anyway, all right.
Can we get some fun stuff?
Yeah, let's get
to some fun stuff. All right, Gru, Lionheart is a 1990 American action film. Some fun facts about Lionheart: that it was released internationally under several names, including AWOL, Absent Without Leave. I think there was a teacher at
There's
my school
a trailer.
That was absent without – wrong bet and Leon. Grew in terms of production, director Sheldon Lettich, who had also co-written Bloodsport, the film that is, you know, essentially credited in making Van Damme into a star, and I would agree to a certain level with that. They had become friends, and Van Damme was impressed with a short film that Lettich made called Firebase, and agreed for Lettich to direct. The director, Sheldon Lettich, is quoted as saying the following: Lionheart was a defining film for Van Damme because I did not shy away from giving him considerable amounts of dialogue and character development throughout the film. I trusted him to pull this off, whereas before, nobody else believed he could do much more than deliver some fancy kicks and simple one-liner. Lionheart was the first movie to demonstrate that Van Damme was more than just a flash in a pan, quote, karate guy who would never rise above simplistic, low-budget karate moves. Gru, thoughts on Mr. Lettich's comments about Lionheart sort of taking Van Damme into the next level, per se, as an actor?
I think he's trying to look back on something through a very nostalgic lens.
Rose-colored
glasses. I didn't see the range that he's referring to here. I didn't quite see it. But look, you know, he's the writer director of the movie. I think that guy went on to some more successful things. If he's asked about something, he's not going to bash it. I don't know if I can agree with that sentiment. I don't think Van Damme was really challenged here. At least he wasn't challenged the way he was later on in his career, as far as acting,
you don't think he's given a little bit more in Lionheart? Because hold on, let me finish my thought. I don't necessarily agree with Lettich, but this movie, I think he's given more. Now, whether he pulls it off, it's another story. But I think he's given more here.
I thought he was given a little bit less.
Now we got a good debate.
I compared this to. Was it Bloodsport where it was him and his brother who went to, you know, was that it? And his brother got hurt and was in the hospital. That was a kickboxer. Kickboxer, okay.
Am I actually referencing Van Damme at a higher level?
Yeah.
Look, by the way, we're a Van Damme podcast. So by the way, what was the blood kick?
Yeah.
kick blood?
Well, because at this point, look, we're in the early part of his career, so they're kind of similar, these things. But I thought that gave him much more of an opportunity to stretch a little bit than this one did.
Well, I will say, without giving my final thoughts on the film, I want to save it. I think he's given a bit more here. Gru, Lionheart is a bit notorious. I mean, I didn't know about this because we get a little shot of Van Damme's naked rear end exposed in one scene. The director, Sheldon Lettich, is quoted as saying, "While we were filming the scene in which he takes a shower in Cynthia's apartment, Van Damme asked me if he might casually, quote, drop his towel and show off his butt for a brief moment. My reply was, sure, if you're willing, why not? We could always use a different take later if we decide it's not a good idea. So we did the one take where he casually lets his towel drop, you know, and he exposes his butt cheeks. This became a very memorable moment for the ladies in the audience and for the gay guys as well."
Did I really say that?
Yes, showing off his butt almost became a signature trademark of Van Damme's after that. Gru, any comments on the naked cheeks in the scene that gay guys love?
Again, Van Damme is ripping off Stallone. Because this is coming right off of Rocky V, where he had that notorious shot in the shower where you could see his ass. So then 6 months later, out comes Lionheart, and of course, I'm not being serious, but maybe that's a little too much of a coincidence. Vanity is just it's seriously. Okay, Van Damme said, "Shoot my ass." Is that what you're telling me?
Well, he didn't say shoot his ass.
I mean, like, film my ass. Well,
here's my thing. If I could take it a bit seriously, this is 1989, 1990.
Yeah.
Now it's sort of in vogue for guys to show like a little skin because of like kind of like equity, because we've had women all these years showing, you know, boobs and butts. So, I mean, this wasn't common back in 1990.
No. Showing a cheek. That's why I'm guessing Van Damme was like, this is a good business move, and he wasn't wrong.
Who had better cheeks, Stallone in Rocky V or Van Damme in Lionheart?
You never really get a full view of Stallone's entire gluteus parts there. look at you guys have no idea what Evan's doing right now. I would have to give this one to Van Damme though.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. Because
he was also 20 years younger than Stallone was when
I was
going to
say he's young, he's ripped.
Yeah.
Stallone's in good shape for Rocky V, but he wasn't in typical sly rip shape, right? I mean,
he was in phenomenal shape for the. I mean, he was in Rocky V. He was younger than us. Yeah, he was still in phenomenal shape. They didn't really let us see it because that wasn't the story. But you see it in other movies around the time, like Cliffhanger and all those. Like he's still ripped. But yeah, he is starting to age at that point. And
what percentage body fat did Stallone have in Rocky V? 3%, 5%, or 7%?
3. I remember reading about it.
Deadline says 5.3%.
Really? I am pretty certain that he has said that he got himself down to 3% body fat and that he felt his health was in danger because of it.
At Rocky V?
No, Rocky IV. Rocky IV, is his best physical condition that he's ever been in.
All right,
but they don't show his ass in that one, so we really have no idea. You know where we can see his ass? The Party at Kitty and Studs, the porn movie he did before Rocky. So if we want to see that, we can get a good shot of Stallone's ass.
Well, I don't want to upset Billie Eilish. I have seen a lot of porn. I have seen a lot of porn, and I've not seen that one, and I will not be seeing that one. So,
but you'll watch Bananas.
Oh, hell yeah. I love that movie. Let's take a gander at the cast of Lionheart. Jean-Claude Van Damme as Leon. Harrison Page as Joshua. I really liked Harrison Page as Joshua in this movie. Deborah Renard as Cynthia. Lisa Pelican as Helene. The great Brian Thompson, and maybe in the beginning phase of his career, as Russell. Michelle Kesey, Tung Po, as Mustafa. And the only other man of note, Billy Blanks of Taibo fame as African Legionnaire. He's the one who gets beat up by Van Damme in the very beginning of the movie. Gru, any thoughts on the overall cast of Lionheart?
Yes, an above average cast as far as names go. I also did spot a couple of character actors in there whose names escape me, but one of them had a role, not a prominent role, but a role nonetheless in Rocky II. If you'll remember, do you remember the agent who was trying to sign Rocky to do all those commercials?
Yes.
So that guy was the promoter or one of the promoters. He's like, I got 3-1 on Lionheart, 3-1 on Lionheart. That guy.
He was also
in Scent of a Woman. He was the Ferrari salesman. So that guy's been around. I have some Lionheart trivia for you. The woman, Deborah Renard, who you mentioned played Cynthia, she had a long running role on a very popular television show, probably for over 10 years, maybe even 13 or 14, I should say. And she was very prominently featured all throughout the run of the series. Do you know what it was?
I mean, I don't, but I'll give a guess. I'll go Knots Landing.
You couldn't be closer. It's Dallas. She was.
What did she play?
She was J.R. Ewing's secretary, Sly. And she was in virtually every episode. She was never part of that opening cast thing. It would always say her name at the end. but she was on like the whole run, and she was always involved in like his scheming and everything. And she was actually, I've never seen her in anything else. So when she popped up in this, I'm like, oh, it's Sly. Look at that. And she wasn't bad. She was good. She chewed the scenery a little bit, but she was good. I liked it. I liked her in this.
I was a huge Dallas fan, but I haven't watched it in so long. But I will say Deborah Renard is pretty stunningly beautiful.
She's beautiful. Yes. I
mean, her figure is just stunning.
Be careful.
In that scene. Be
careful.
She,
be careful.
I just said stunning. Stunning.
Even that is like, what do you mean by stunning?
But let's sexually? Go to, you mentioned a quick point. You said that she chews up the scenery. Were you, are you not a fan of her performance in this film?
Well, she, by chew the scenery, I mean she overdoes it a little bit, but I think the movie calls for it. You know, she probably could have taken it down a notch. It did seem like she was trying a little too hard, but, you know, maybe that's what it called for. I mean, this is not, I mean, I'm going to give away part of my feeling about the movie here just because it that's what this is about. She, I think the movie could have been better if they decided to ground it a little more with these kind of performances. The over-the-top kind of scenery-chewing performances that everybody is given, especially Harrison. What's his last name? I'm sorry. Harrison what?
Harrison Page.
Yeah, you know, him too. Like, they're really going for it here. And maybe that's because it is a glorified B-movie. But I feel like there could have been a lot more if they took it down a notch and didn't make it so campy. But maybe that's what they were going for. So if that's what they were going for, it works.
I don't think they're trying to make it campy. And I thought actually Harrison Page, for the time period and the character, you know, he's a street guy.
Yeah.
I thought he could have been. And if you really want any Eddie Murphy action, I mean, I thought he was really, really good. I didn't get the sense of really over the topness. I have some real definite thoughts of the movie. Do you want me to go through?
No, I want you. Oh, no, let's go through the plan. Whatever the plan is, let's do that.
Well, I don't want to read the whole summary of this, so I'm just going to start off. I'll try to give it in little bits and pieces. But of course, the movie opens up with Lyon's brother, who's getting who gets beat up by a drug dealer. It's a drug deal gone bad. The young man gets set on fire. Perhaps he's dead, but we find out that he's in the hospital, and eventually that's Lyon Van Damme's brother. He eventually dies, leaving his widow and a young daughter. Lyon Gaultier, Jean-Claude, is a French Foreign Legion officer. He tries to leave, and again they tell him no, and he has this daring breakout and scamps across the desert, and they want to put him in the brig, and somehow he defeats, you know, 9 military officers, hops into a jeep, and off he goes in the desert. What'd you think of that opening salvo to start off Lionheart?
Well, it's funny because I think I watched the unrated director's cut, because when he got to the United States, they checked his vaccination status and they kicked him right back, so they wouldn't let him in.
Hi-yo!
It's actually a cool story. I mean, like, look, there aren't that many like stories out there. This is and it's how you tell them and how you sort of add to them or play with them. And on paper, it sounds great. It sounds like a cool adventure. This guy, this French military guy, finds out that his brother is all fucked up all the way on the west coast of the United States, and he's got to get there.
Los Angeles.
Yeah, and he's got to get there. He's got to get to his family, and he has to jump through all of these kind of crazy hoops, and he gets involved in order to make the money to be able to go there. He's got to enter these gladiator contests. That's a great pitch for a movie. So, yeah, story-wise, I love it.
I mean, my point was, when you start with the opening credits of the movie, there is a bigger look to this Van Damme movie. And that's what I meant about my earlier comment. I mean, this is not, to me, some chop socky. Now, it may end up a B movie, but there's actual musical score, which was a little bit busy. there's production. There's some money in
this. You didn't like that solo saxophone in the beginning?
Oh, my God. I didn't know if I was watching an episode of L.A. Law. Like walking into a building.
I was like, is this Three Men and a Baby? What happened?
I'll give you my thoughts when we get to the review. But when I started watching it, all of a sudden you're in this big sweeping backdrop of East Africa and desert and Foreign Legion. I was like, whoa, this is a little bit of a bigger movie than some chop socky kind of deal.
Well,
that was my point. I'm not saying they pulled it off better or worse. I'll let you know at the end, but it's a bigger scope of a movie here. I mean,
I think the reason for that is because by this point he was a star. You know, he was too big to give the $500,000 budget. You know, like, remember, this is like, he did No Retreat, No Surrender, which he was the bad guy. Then he did Kickboxer. Then he did
barely in No Retreat, No Surrender.
Right, he's
in for a
couple. They marketed it very differently, though. But then, like Bruce Willis in his movies today. Van Damme's going backwards. And then he does Kickboxer, then he does Bloodsport, and now Bloodsport.
Then he does Kickboxer.
Right. Okay. Bloodsport made him known. Kickboxer made him a star. So now, when he's going into this, he is one of the big action stars of the time. So it's got to be bigger. And you're right. There is a much bigger scope, and you could tell they spent more money on it than some of the other movies.
I just want to say, I love Bloodsport more than Kickboxer. Thank you. And the other thing is,
so do I.
I feel like with Double Impact coming, this is like the end of phase one. This is like MCU.
Yeah.
I feel like this is the end of the first kind of era of Van Damme films. It feels like that to me. And again, I'll watch Double Impact, but this feels like he's moving on to the next leg. So Gru already references, he gets on like a steamship, and he's, I don't know, like he beats up, like, there's a black guy who runs the deal. He beats him up to stay on the ship, and then he jumps in the water, and he somehow gets to New York, where Gru talks about there's sort of like an illegal street fight kind of deal going on in the streets of the city. And there, that's where he meets Joshua, and Joshua takes him to meet Cynthia Caldera, an unscrupulous organizer of underground fights for the rich elite. Sort of like an early version of Fight Club. We're moving the story along. Gru, Van Damme's now in New York. Fish out of water. Meets Joshua. Meets Cynthia, the wealthy folks. We got Cynthia and Russell. Where are we going from here? What do you think so far?
Well, it's. You know how you mentioned how it begins and it feels much bigger and better and like. That beginning part with the military stuff.
Well,
when he gets to New York, you know, when he goes to New York, not when he gets there, but when he goes to New York, we feel like we don't really know what's going to happen here. There's anticipation, like, how's he going to get there? What's going to happen? I mean, we know he's going to have to fight his way there. Then when he meets up with these people, that's when it gets into, okay, let's check the boxes. We've got the unscrupulous promoter. We've got the minority best friend. We've got, you know, like, it seems like there. That's when it falls into formula. That doesn't mean it's a bad formula, but where it could have taken some surprising turns, they really went right into, you know, script writing 101 at that point.
We've seen this before in Van Damme movies.
Yes, in way more than Van Damme movies. Yes, especially
right. We've seen,
especially Bloodsport. Like, it's all about his brother being half dead, you know, like, and somehow miraculously the Muscles from Brussels also always has these American brothers. It's weird, isn't it? Like,
the brother's French. He has a French accent when they have the drug deal. He definitely has a French accent.
Oh, he wasn't on screen long enough because by the time, spoiler alert, by the time he gets there, he's dead, right?
Right. And he yells out, Leon! In the hospital. Well, Cynthia agrees to sponsor Leon, and she dubs him Lionheart, hence the title of the movie.
3-1 on Lionheart. 3-1 on Lionheart.
Of course, he runs through all of his opponents, and he lets Josh know, I got to get to L.A. So Josh calls in a favor from Cynthia, who gets them both across the states to L.A. By the time he reaches the hospital, he realizes that his brother has died. Although the murderers are apprehended, the wife, his brother's wife, the widow, was left penniless. She's got the stack of unpaid bills and the little daughter, Nicole, to look after her. So now the plan is we're going to go to L.A. to fight, and they're going to support Helene, with her medical bills. Van Damme goes to see Helene, and she kind of spurs him. She's angry at him. Where have you been? And basically, he decides he's going to help them from afar. Hopefully I'm summarizing the movie.
No, you are.
Correctly. Andrew, what are your thoughts up to this point?
Well, there is an aspect of this that does not make any sense at all. And
which is?
Helene writes him towards the beginning that they need help with all the medical bills. He can't get himself from New York to Los Angeles. What makes her think that he's going to be able to pay for all this shit? He's got nothing. Is she a little cross promotion there? Is she saying, please come out here and fight to the death so we can pay for these medical bills? Like what? Like she doesn't know that he's going to be this gladiator. She thinks does she think he's some kind of rich French, diplomat or something? So that whole thing doesn't make sense. And then, of course, we see this guy go through hell to get there. Finally, when he gets there, she's mad at him.
I mean,
what a bitch.
I know. he really goes through hell to get to L.A.
I mean, relax, Celine.
When he's on the steamship, he jumps into the water, and they show him walking the streets in New York all wet with his wet outfit. And
he's the bad guy to her because her husband was a fucking drug dealer.
Well, doesn't she blame him for his involvement in the drug business? I don't know how that was.
I think she does. They don't really explore that unless I missed something. Was Leon a bad kid and then he left?
No, I mean, if anything, I've never seen a guy more angelic in his life.
Was he like a bad kid when they were kids, and did he abandon his family to France or something? I don't know.
What I'm saying, which was I had a whole joke lined up, I've never seen a more angelic character. I can't imagine. I mean, I'm sure he was, in front of a store doing March of Dimes in Christmas, ringing the bell. There's nothing that this guy won't do for his family.
I joined the army, the Salvation Army.
Right, Salvation. I mean, it's hard to that Helene's even mad at him. So he's going to fight Gru, and Joshua's going to help him out. And Joshua goes to the to Helene, and he gives her money, and he's saying that somehow this was her husband had subscribed to a life insurance policy prior to his death. We see Van Damme as Lion defeat a number of high-profile artists, a dirty fighting Scotsman, a wrestler in a racquetball court. That was an interesting locale for a fight. And a martial artist in a shallow, dirty swimming pool. That was
They got creative with that. They got creative with some of the fighting locales.
Good. It was good. What'd you think of some of those fights? Because, the one thing I'll say before I throw it to you is – They the scope of the fights are bigger, but they still fall for that like double shot where he goes ha! They do like the two kicks, like that jump cut. Like they still do that crap, and it just looks a little bit chop-socky and cheap to me.
It still does. He will break out of that eventually, not in this movie, but but they're fun to watch because they're so cartoony. Because of the locations, like in that pool, and like they're fun to watch. What it reminded me of, and this Seagal people will probably appreciate this. You might too, because we saw it together. Under Siege 2, the one on the train. Not a good movie, but there's one great fight scene where he's fighting a bad guy in the train's kitchen, and all they're doing is using kitchen utensils to do all this fighting. He's got like spatulas and pans and pots. They're both like, instead of kendo sticks, they're fighting with pans and pots. It's really creative and fun. Stupid as hell, but fun to watch. And that's what I felt about some of these fights. They were like, they got a little creative like that. They could have gone further, but it was enjoyable. They were fun to watch. The stakes weren't there though. That's the thing. And I don't mean, you know, I don't mean barbecue steaks. I mean high stakes. You really didn't feel the urgency, which should come with a movie like this.
Well, like I guess in the final stanza, you have now the two legionnaires, Mustafa and like the colonel, almost like a wrestling gimmick. They come to the United States and they're going to track down Leon, and then Cynthia grows suspicious of Leon and sort of jealous because she finds out that he's sending his monies towards Helene. We have the great chase scene where the legionnaires try to track down Van Damme and he's saved by Russell. And you sort of think Russell's maybe a good guy, but he's kind of a dick at the very end. And this all sort of culminates in the final fight against Attila. They watch a grainy videotape. Oh, that's what happened. So Attila sort of is known for suckering in his opponents. And I think they gimmick the videotape so they don't see Attila beating the crap out of his final opponent. And yeah. Joshua and Leon agree to the final fight. And Cynthia, you know, sort of, I guess, meets the Legionnaires and they have an agreement. And the Legionnaires are waiting for Leon at the final fight. And, of course, typical Van Damme style, Attila, like, literally beats the crap out of Leon. And Joshua begs him to stop the fight and says, hey, I got the bet. Let's stop now. Lose. We'll go 50-50 on whatever money. And, oh, Joshua admits that he bet on Attila. And Van Damme, great line. He says, you bet on the wrong guy. And he gets up and he gets that final burst of energy. And he defeats Attila, but spares his life. Mm-hmm. There's that, you know, that scene where Attila's a bloody mess.
Did he squeeze his nose and honk, you know, like...
No, he didn't do that. He didn't do that. And definitely a little bit of an interesting ending. For me, anyway, the Legionnaires take Van Damme into custody. He says goodbye to his family, asks Joshua to take care of Helene and the little girl who he's grown fond over. And they take him into custody. Maybe drive a half mile, a mile down the road. They pull over. And Mustafa says, get out of the car, something to the effect of, you know, you were honorable in, you know, trying to help out your family. We're going to forgive you of your ills or your debts toward the Legionnaire. And he's a free man in America. And he jogs back triumphantly back to the house and a lot of hugs. And the film ends with him being reunited with his family and Joshua. I hope I summarized it pretty well.
You did.
What'd you think of that final stanza, the action, and the ending of the movie?
The final like fighting part, it was run of the mill. I did like the thing about him betting on the other guy. The ending is to me the best thing in the movie because you don't. It's the only part that's really unpredictable a little bit. I wanted the movie to end with him being driven away. He accomplished what he set out to do, for better or worse. He knew he was betraying his government, but family first, and he was willing to accept the consequences. And I would have liked, like, it would have been interesting to see, like, Mustafa say to him, he's like, listen, you know, like, we got to take it in. On a personal note, you know, I respect what you did, but the law is the law. And Van Damme could have been like, I know, let's do it. And then end the movie there. Unpredictable. He did what he needed to do. But this was the tail end of the 80s, and you got to tie everything up with a bow. So you know, he lets them out, and then he goes back. And it's nice, and everybody feels nice and walks out with a smile on their face and maybe a little happy. And then we move on with our lives. But I would have liked to have seen the unpredictable one where the good guy makes the, if not the ultimate sacrifice, the big sacrifice. I would have liked to have seen that, but it wasn't to be.
Yeah, the ending you're quoting sounds like that could have been a good ending if they wanted to perhaps make a sequel. I mean, that could have been a nice way to, you know, you have sort of a question mark. I hear what you're saying. I think the ending is a little bit Hollywood-y, so to speak. But Woody. It didn't, boing. It didn't really, didn't bother me per se.
It didn't bother me either. I just, you know me, I'm a fucking snob, and sometimes sometimes I watch these things and I think about how I would have done it better. You know, I admit that.
No, interesting point. Now, you know, Mustafa is played by Michelle Kesey, who played Tung Po.
Yes.
So Attila is his brother. I forget his name, but Attila is Michelle Kesey's younger brother. I found that to be a bit interesting. Gru, do you want to take a gander at the box office for Lionheart?
Yes.
What the budget of the movie might have been, and what was the? You can give me whatever the gross. All right,
let's go budget. Let's go budget first.
Remember 1990.
It's still a very low budget movie, but it's a high low budget movie.
Go ahead.
So I'm going to say between 8 and 10 million budget.
Okay. I'm writing your number down. And now please give me the total gross worldwide.
Okay. I remember it being successful, borderline hit, which at the time, worldwide, huh? Let's say 25 million. I don't remember it being like a super. I didn't see it in the movies. In fact, I saw it for the first time yesterday.
Great.
No, I look. These guys make hundreds of movies. I haven't seen every Stallone movie ever made.
Listen, hold on, Andrew. This is a Van Damme podcast. We got to give the illusion. We still have Jean-Claude Van Damme posters in our room.
Hey, we were not given a choice here. You know,
this is true. All right,
I'll stick with that. We'll see where that gets us.
One thing, my man Gru knows his stuff, and he speaks it, so he has a real clear line of thought. So really? I got to give him credit. He said a high. Low budget movie. Andrew said 8 to 10 million. I have the budget at 6 million, so fairly in the range. Andrew said the film earned 25 million gross, which would put it as a mild hit. 24.3 million.
Wow!
Worldwide. So you were very close. All right, we're gonna get Andrew's final review in a second. A 1 to 4 on the French crepe.
Hey, can you look up something real quick? Are you able to do that?
Yeah, sure.
Because I think Lionheart came out the same year as Rocky V. I remember Rocky V was a flop. Did this outgross Rocky V?
What was the gross for Rocky V?
Did this outgross it? That'd be crazy.
How much money did Rocky V make? I have 120 million US.
All right, then forget it. Then I remember it being not successful, but that's pretty successful for 1990.
120 million worldwide, made 41 million total in the US and Canada.
41 million a Rocky movie making 41, that sucks. That's horrible. Wow.
Rocky V, however, made almost twice as much overseas with a gross of $79
million. Yeah,
I told you. To give it a total of $120 million.
They love these. They love their big American action stars over in Europe. They really do.
Yeah. Iran number one. let's see here, Gru. The critical response to Kickboxer, unfortunately, the overall critical view of the film is negative. Most of the critical receptions for the film were negative. On the review aggregate website Rotten Tomatoes, it holds an approval rating of 31% based on 16 reviews. Gru, Metascore on 41 reviews gave it a score of 41. One positive review, 6 mixed, 3 negative. On Metascore, the film user scored a 6.0 on a 1 to 10 scale with 7 mixed reviews, 1 negative, only 4 positive. Let me give you IMDb top fan review. Up there in Van Damme's top 5 films. Let me just see if there. He's basically saying, you want to laugh yourself senseless, go watch a Rennie Harlan flick, but you want to see some serious hurting on screen, let Van Damme loose. I am tired of the incessant complaints that Van Damme can act. Did anyone ever say he could? He has many of his detractors, but who could do better? Could John Wayne? Did anyone ever want to see him being anything but John Wayne? JCVD does a half-decent job here, I have to say, and it strikes me as a case of him let him who is not without sin, et cetera, when it comes to assassinating his thespian talents. This film has plenty going for it. Action, conviction, and courage. In this genre in which it finds itself necessarily categorized, I give it a score of 7 from 1 out of 10. So there, Andrew, give you a little bit of a feel. Andrew is give us some hints on how he feels about Lionheart. But Andrew Gruthius, the proverbial floor is yours. Did Van Damme improve upon Kickboxer? Did he progress as a thespian? Do we even care? Gru, let's hear a review. How many French crepes? Van Damme, Lionheart.
Well, the movies are progressing faster than he is as an actor. So I'm gonna do something a little unprecedented. I'm gonna give this 2 reviews. It's French crepes, you say?
Yes.
Okay, my crepes, movie yeah. snob review is 1.5 because watching it yesterday, I kept every turn, I was like, that could have been done better. That could have been done better. I was very critical of pretty much everything. It was still fun, but it bothers me so much when I see things that could be so much better with maybe just a little bit more money or better writing or whatever, and I just saw too much convention, and that did not improve on what it's not better or worse than Kickboxer or Bloodsport. It's the same, and it shouldn't be. It should be a step up, and it's not. His performance is he's not an actor, and he doesn't try to be. So I don't know why we keep expecting that. His best performance, well, I'm not even going to give that away. When we get to the movie, I'll tell you. But my second review is going to be 3 French crepes because I'm...
Wow.
Here's why. Because I know...
But what...
Here's why. I'm going to tell you. Because I know that if you and I saw this movie together in 1990, we would have walked out of the theater like... Fuck yeah. That was awesome. It's the best movie I've ever seen. And then the next week, we would have forgotten we saw it. But we would have loved it when we saw it, and that counts for something. So I'm going to get – so my 1990 self, my 15-year-old self is giving it 3. My 46-year-old self is giving it 1.5. Does that make sense at all?
Yeah, I'm going to defer to your 46-year-old review. I think that's probably the more – the more authentic.
Okay.
My thoughts on it right now?
Please.
Okay. What I like about this movie, production values really jump up here. This looks like a bigger film. We've already said that. I liked Harrison Page as Joshua. I thought the cast can act. I thought they were decent actors. You had some comedy elements here, and I thought Van Damme did show some increased range. What I disliked... my favorite line in the movie is, "Don't know if I want to fight you or fuck you."
Yeah, that was good.
Fighting style straight out of the 80s.
That was ahead of its time, by the way. Because it was a guy talking to a guy.
Yeah, well.
And I was telling him how pretty he was. No, you got to acknowledge that because that was not mainstream type stuff back then. It is
now. I thought the guy was just talking trash. Like, I didn't consider the guy anything with his sexuality. But
today's audience would see it that way. They would see it like – they would be like, oh, he calls him pretty. You know, today's cynical audience would see it that way.
Yeah, enough woke agenda. We've had enough woke agenda for today's show.
That is true.
So I think my problem for the movie was, Andrew, I don't know if you agree with me, it doesn't know what it wants to be. Does it want to be a sweeping Does it want to be a sweeping road epic like an Indiana Jones with desert backdrops and you're in the city and it, or is it a fish out of water movie? Now we got a French guy and a black guy in New York City, and you know he's in a fight club. Then is it almost like Warriors? Like he's got to fight his way to get to Los Angeles, and then sometimes they're in front of a building, and I felt like I was watching an episode of L.A. Law with that sort of that television sitcom-y music, and everybody's in suits, and then there's some comedy aspects to it. Like I felt like Lionheart can never really settle in on what it wants to be as a movie. So actually my feelings are converse to This Is the Night, where I feel like the pieces were enjoyable, but at the end of the movie I'm like, it's not great. It's not great. So I was enjoying some of the individual pieces and the performances, but when the movie is over, it's kind of campy and it's not great. So I give it 2.25. I think it's better. It's just a notch better than an okay movie.
Yeah.
I give it 2.25 French Crepes because I feel like actually I'd put it on the director. Like I don't know what this movie wanted to be. Is it a comedy? Is it an action comedy? Is it a buddy cop movie?
Yeah.
Is it like an Indiana Jones sweeping epic? Like I don't know like what this movie wants
to
be.
It meanders, definitely. Yeah, yeah. And like I said, when like before he got to New York, I saw it going in different directions, and then it settles into a formulaic kind of thing where it really does not know what it wants to be. You couldn't be more right about that. But yeah, look, it's still in the lexicon. I mean, people know this movie. It's funny to me because I look at some of these movies and people like them. People love Bloodsport. We're doing Cobra Kai in a couple weeks. They actually
I love Bloodsport. I did not like Kickboxer, but really liked Bloodsport for what it is, so to speak.
Yeah, and it's funny because I see these movies, how people respond to them, and then I see how they respond to some of Stallone's lesser efforts, and they're so much better than these. Yet I guess people expected more from Stallone because he started so strong. Like he started with an Oscar winner and then kind of, you know, in the public's eye kind of became this caricature. But look, whatever it was, it worked for him. Remember, like we talked in the beginning, it is a business. And these movies are making money, and if they can, the whole thing of business is to try to make as much money you can by spending as little as you can. On that front, Jean-Claude Van Damme is a monster success, and so is this movie.
Yes, and this is a Van Damme podcast, so I will stick to Van Damme-ness. I will not comment on Sylvester Stallone. To your point, this would be my last point. I got to urinate and get to wrap this.
It's lunchtime for you.
I feel like Lionheart is, if you looked at a bar graph, it would be slightly below the halfway point to the end as in terms of like the Van Damme filmography, like in terms of being known. Like I definitely know Lionheart when I started. I remember it. I remember seeing it years ago. But that's like I don't remember much more about it. Like I definitely knew Bloodsport. I knew Kickboxer, even though I didn't really enjoy Kickboxer. But like Lionheart, it was like I remember it, and I always remember the French deal. Like I remembered that piece.
Right.
That was about it. It doesn't have the
kind of staying power that Bloodsport had, and that some of his later ones have too. But we'll get to that.
Well,
those.
let's talk about staying power for our next Van Damme podcast. Please listen intentively as our February episode will be 1991's Double Impact. Double Van Damme. One packs a punch. One packs a piece. Together they deliver. Grew perhaps the head muckety muck of Last of the Action Hero Podcast Network, Ryan Rabalkin, had requested to join us for this one. Grew, give us a little bit of some thoughts on 1991, Van Damme, Double Impact.
Well, I hope that Mr. Rabalkin doesn't take back his invitation. I look forward to every single one that we do, and this one is no different. But unlike Lionheart, Double Impact is one that I have seen, but not in a long time. So I am definitely looking forward to rewatching. I am excited for that one because there's a lot I remember, but more that I don't. So I'm looking forward to seeing it and then talking about it with you and Ryan. Without a doubt, that's gonna be fun.
Yes, phase two of the VDU.
Yes, phase two.
Universe.
It's interesting. You know what? It's interesting that you said that, because if you look at all these careers, they are like that. Like, to me, like, take Steven Seagal. I'll only use Seagal because I know we're getting long on time here. But Seagal has phase one, which is like Above the Law, Hard to Kill, Marked for Death, Under Siege, Out for Justice, and maybe On Deadly Ground, like his directorial debut. Then after that comes the wave of high-profile, straight-to-video movies like Fire Down Below and The Patriot. And then phase three is where he is now, and just like five straight-to-streaming movies a year. So it's interesting that you use like that analogy with the phases of the career. And I'm going to start looking at different performers through that lens. It's interesting.
Is this the is this phase for Seagal the fat bloated with a bad hairpiece or a hair?
Well, that started in phase two. That by the time he became like a huge action star, he was definitely enjoying the fruits of stardom a little too much, I would say.
Yes. I'm killing people to protect the environment.
Oh my God! That movie with Michael Caine is the bad guy. That was that was the one he directed. That was the one he directed on Deadly Ground. That
maybe
was terrible.
You know what? We're gonna do a Van Damme. We're gonna do that Seagal movie. I'd like to do that with you. We'll keep that in mind for the books. But
what do you mean?
I want to do on Deadly Ground. We're gonna do.
Oh
Van
yeah,
Damme.
Yeah. We could do that. We could do that as a Nothing Worthwhile. We don't need to do that as
no. Van Damme will do the 80s action stars. Well,
okay.
They cover our shit. Why can't
that's
we
that's true? Good point. Good
else?
Point. Good point. Good point.
Screw them. Screw them.
Oh my God, we're in so much trouble.
I'm doing this podcast on. No, I'm joking. Grew. Next week, Andrew and I shall return for Nothing Worthwhile as we do our annual Cobra Kai roundtable. Gru, season 4 is in the books. Did the Netflix series deliver on all of the Karate Kid excitement? Thoughts on an impending season 5? Join us next week for Nothing Worthwhile Cobra Kai season 4 roundtable. Andrew, thoughts?
As always, with Cobra Kai, can't wait. I love talking about this show, and if you thought I was a blowhard today... Just wait till next week. No, I'm really listen. When Cobra Kai comes out, there's so much to unpack, so much to talk about, and I really do enjoy talking about it, especially with you. So, definitely, really excited to unpack what the season that was Cobra Kai 4.
Yeah. Actually, I'm going to have to wash my karate gi because I'm going to have to wear it for the season 4 Cobra Kai roundtable.
I have my Cobra Kai gi I could wear.
Actually, you know, it's funny. I was in Tucson earlier this week, and I saw Miguel at the border. He was going to visit his dad in Mexico.
You said that. I didn't say it.
All right. Well, no, I love how he throws me under the bus. Every opportunity. Throw me under the bus.
I thought you were gonna start going in the Tucson train.
Well, before any of us get into a lot of hot water, let's say that is it for this episode of Van Damme It. Andrew and I bid you fond adieu as we say no retreat
and no surrender. We'll be Not seeing you next week, buddy. Right?
We'll see you next week.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, next week, Cobra Kai Season 4, followed by Double Impact the week after. And then, who knows, we could go anywhere. All you got to do is stay tuned to find out. But until then, ladies and gentlemen, 1, 2, 3.
Ripple, ripple! Knox and Cow, everybody. But they fought with expert timing. There were funky Chinamen from funky.
Chinatown.